Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present labor journalist David Bacon, who takes a look at the U.S. immigration debate and the winners and losers if provisions of some proposed reform legislation is signed into law. Tony Clark, director of Canada's Polaris Institute, who reports on the World Water Forum and its global agenda for the privatization of water resources. And Australian peace activist Marcus Atkinson, who discusses walks for peace taking place in the U.S. and around the world that he believes can support conflict resolution and protection of the environment. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The Washington Post reports undercover government investigators carried enough low-level radioactive cesium-137 into U.S. ports to manufacture two dirty bombs. Cesium-137 is a radioisotope commonly used for cancer therapy and industrial applications. The surprise drill, by agents of the Government Accounting Office, the oversight arm of Congress, got the material into ports in Washington State and Texas, even though they set off radiation alarms. The undercover agents used false documents to gain access to the ports. Jason Ahern, Assistant Commissioner for the Department of Homeland Security, defended the actions of border agents for following official protocol. Yet the agents were not able to confirm the identification of the undercover testers before they were allowed in the ports. The GAO report is the latest indication of deficiencies in the protection of U.S. ports and airport security from nuclear, biological, and chemical threats. The oversight agency in another report concluded it was unlikely the Department of Homeland Security would install over 3,000 state-of-the-art radiation detectors to border crossings by September 2009, as mandated by law. The center-right Council for Foreign Relations has also complained that threats of nuclear terrorism are not being taken seriously by the Bush administration. The women of Vikas Sagar, a squatter community in Mumbai, India, still worry about the threat of surging floodwaters and having enough money to buy food in the city of 12 million urban dwellers. Despite its appearance, the squatter community is making progress. Its residents live in concrete houses and the walkways are paved. The women also participate in a communal savings plan, giving them access to microloans. According to the New Internationalist magazine, these gains were won by aggressive grassroots organizing. Eager to open land for development, officials in Mumbai have sent in the police to destroy 90,000 squatter homes, leaving tens of thousands of people homeless. It is a scene replayed across the globe. Outsiders often see squatter communities as outposts of poverty, misery, disease, and rampant crime. They don't see dozens of health clinics, food merchants, bars and restaurants, or churches and schools. In Mumbai alone, squatters, who make up half the city, have saved $32 million in communal saving accounts for building 80,000 homes. It also allowed 125,000 squatters to buy land. In early February, riots engulfed the Los Angeles County prison system. Black and Latino inmates in overcrowded conditions got into numerous confrontations, large and small, leaving corrections officers who are trained in SWAT tactics powerless to stop the mayhem. To break the cycle of violence, L.A. County Sheriff Lee Baca locked down the entire county jail complex, preventing inmates from bathing, doing laundry, or receiving visits from family members. In public statements, Sheriff Baca blamed the unrest on an interracial war among rival gangs from South Los Angeles. The month-long unrest left two prisoners dead and hundreds injured. According to the news magazine In These Times, the corporate media coverage of the riots largely ignored the overcrowded prison conditions. It also overlooked the corrections department policy of explicitly segregating ethnic groups as a way of controlling violent gangs. During the first week of the prison riots, the Southern California chapter of the ACLU called for improved staffing inside the county prison complex, better health care for inmates, and modern facilities. The unrest also confirms the fear of prison reformers like Rose Braz, head of the group Critical Resistance. As she told In These Times, corrections departments have long used racial segregation and the pitting of prisoner against prisoner as the means of quelling any prisoner solidarity, much less prisoner organizing. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Bill Cosentino. Thank you.
As immigration reform legislation was debated in Congress, hundreds of thousands of immigrants and their supporters have marched in cities from coast to coast across America. Their large numbers, 500,000 in Chicago and even more in Los Angeles, illustrated what's at stake for the immigrant community if proposed laws are passed that criminalize undocumented workers living in the United States. The leading legislative proposals now before Congress deal with two main paths to reform. The version passed by the House, sponsored by Ohio GOP Representative Sensenbrenner, takes a punitive approach by making undocumented immigrants and those who assist them felons, increasing employer sanctions and border security, but offers no provisions for legalization. The Senate is considering a less draconian measure, sponsored by Senators McCain of Arizona and Kennedy of Massachusetts, that proposes a guest worker program and a process for legalization. Within this often emotional debate, strains of xenophobia can be seen in groups like the Minutemen, whose volunteers, criticized by many as vigilantes, patrol border areas without government sanction. Between the Lines' Scott Harris spoke with labor journalist David Bacon, who takes a look at the U.S. immigration debate and the winners and losers among corporations and workers if provisions of some proposed reform legislation is signed into law.
Since the late 1990s, large U.S. corporations got together in quite a formal coalition called the Essential Worker Immigration Coalition and began advocating the creation of guest worker programs. And these are programs that are kind of like the old Bracero program that existed in the U.S. between 1942 and 1964. And what these programs would allow companies to do would be to go to countries like Mexico or Central America or the Philippines or the Caribbean and recruit workers who would then come to the U.S. under temporary visas and who would be subject to a great deal of control by their employers and consequently would essentially be forced to work as a much cheaper source of labor than companies might be able to get if they had to depend on a domestic labor supply. And they have been advocating this in Congress quite consistently over a period of years. So that's sort of been one of the dynamics pushing this debate forward. And I think that on the one hand, big companies, big corporations see that their time has come, in essence, that, you know, this is a good moment for them to push for them because really, because of the extreme xenophobic nature of some of the proposals in Congress, they've been able to put forward their guest worker plans and pretend that these are somehow liberal alternatives to proposals by, like the one by Congressman Sensenbrenner that passed through the House last December, that would essentially turn all 12 million undocumented people in the United States into federal felons. And I think they're also nervous about Bush's declining political capital and the fact that the administration has only a little over 2 years to go, and that if they are going to get what they want, they have to kind of make their move.
David, I'd like to get your comment on the massive mobilization of immigrants and their supporters all across this country in these giant demonstrations that I think really shocked the country to some extent. What effect, if any, will these demonstrations of opposition to the most draconian bills being proposed in Congress, what effect, if any, do you think it will have?
These were demonstrations of ordinary working people and families who came out of their homes and came into the street in most cases for the first time in their lives. And what is causing this, on the one hand, is, you know, as you say, these draconian proposals, especially the proposal that would turn 12 million people without papers into federal felons. That one has been like an electric shock to people's families because there are so many families in the U.S. now that have family members who would become criminals were this to pass. But I think that there is also a positive demand that's being made by these marches, and that is these are marches overwhelmingly for equality. People are saying, we want equal rights. We want to be part of the community just like everybody else. We don't want a second-class status. We don't want to be looked at as inferior, as just simply people whose only function in life is to work and make other people rich. You know, we want equality. And I think that that puts them very squarely in the middle of the tradition of civil rights movements historically in this country. This is the same demand that was made by African-American people when they went into the streets in Selma, Alabama at the end of the 1950s and the early 1960s. When you take those demands for equality and you measure them up against what Congress has in mind, you can see how far from reality our congressional members are. You know, these are hopefully going to produce the motive power to defeat, you know, both of these approaches in Congress, both the criminalization and the guest worker approaches. You know, these are hundreds of thousands of people who, when they get organized and mobilized, can vote, can organize unions, can exercise political and economic power, and are going to do that.
We did leave out an important element of this conversation, and maybe we can devote the last minute or so, if you have another moment to spare here. You know, the situation in Mexico is such that many people feel that they're forced to come here to look for work to support their families.
You know, NAFTA increased the pressure on Mexicans to come here. You know, corn exports, you know, privatization of Mexican businesses with the layoffs of tens of thousands of workers, maintaining a low-wage economy for the convenience of U.S. corporations that wanted to, you know, go to Mexico and build factories in order to cut their labor costs. All of these things produce economic pressure on people. And how people respond to it, you know, I mean, Mexico's a big country, and people respond in a variety of different ways, but one big response is people come here. In fact, in Mexico, you know, the kind of common and accepted wisdom is that every family in Mexico now has somebody, some member of it, living on the other side of the border in the U.S. That's how common it's become. So if we don't like that, we should stop negotiating treaties like that. We should stop negotiating a world order for the convenience of corporations, you know, and their ability to cut their labor costs. Andrés Manuel López Obrador, the left-wing candidate for president of Mexico, basically has said that his solution to the migration questions is not like, you know, current President Fox, who supports this guest worker plan of Bush's, but what he proposes to do is to raise incomes, especially in the Mexican countryside, and make it possible for people to, you know, stay in their towns of origin rather than being forced to leave for economic reasons.
That was labor journalist David Bacon. Read Bacon's articles online at his website at dbacon.igc.org. In 1999, the people of Cochabamba, Bolivia, organized a successful rebellion, reversing the privatization of the city's municipal water system. Militant resistance was initiated after the U.S.-based Bechtel Corporation began charging exorbitant prices for water, placing the essential resource out of reach of many residents. Large water companies like Suez, Veolia, and RWE Thames have launched efforts to take over public water supplies around the world. The Fourth World Water Forum, a gathering of powerful water corporations, financial firms, and government agencies, was held from March 16th to the 22nd in Mexico City. However, the forum's agenda of solving the world's water problems through privatization was countered at the conference when tens of thousands of opponents of privatization came to Mexico City to protest the commodification of water. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Tony Clark, director of Canada's Polaris Institute, who attended the World Water Forum in Mexico. Clark, who is the co-author, along with Maud Barlow, of the book Blue Gold, The Fight to Stop Corporate Theft of the World's Water, explains why he and a growing international movement opposes the privatization of water resources.
Well, all over the world right now, I mean, we're doubling our use of water at a far faster rate than people imagine. We're doubling at a rate of once every 20 years. That means that we are, this is twice the rate of population growth, which means that there's a huge demand coming for water, not only in terms of agriculture, industrialized agriculture, but also in terms of new industries and requiring a lot more heavy use of water. And then when we combine that with the fact that through mining and various other industries, such as hog farming and things like that, we are really polluting the groundwater systems at a very rapid rate. So the amount of available fresh, clean water for human consumption, for plant consumption, is dramatically dwindling.
Amidst this shortage of water resources is, over the last few years, a gathering called the World Water Forum. Tell us a little bit about who the corporations and institutions are that are behind the World Water Forum.
Well, the World Water Forum is an event that occurs every 3 years. It brings together a lot of people from local governments and from civic associations, I suppose, in various countries around the world. But it really is run by both the World Bank and the IMF, and those kinds of institutions on the one hand, and by the Global Water Corporations on the other. They're the ones that really set the agenda for what happens at the World Water Forum. So you have Suez and Veolia and RWE Thames, which are the largest for-profit corporations involved in the privatization of water services, and they play a big role in the shaping of the World Water Forum, as does the World Bank, which finances much of the takeover of public water systems by for-profit corporations in developing countries in the Global South.
Tony, I would just ask you, as you look at the drive for privatization of water resources, what are some of the problems with it and dangers for basic human survival in that these companies are using water as a profit center rather than, using it as a basic resource for human life?
You know, we're talking, about a vital resource that should be universally available to all people and, for that matter, to nature itself. When we put this in the hands of the market, when we put this in the hands of for-profit corporations or the private sector, it means that, you know, like any product, it gets distributed on the basis of the ability to pay. Those that have the ability to pay get the service. Those that don't do not get the service, this kind of thing. And this is one of the fundamental problems. When a corporation takes over the running of a public water utility, several things immediately happen, regardless of where this happens, and that is, first of all, the price or the water rates are jacked up. Secondly, you have, you know, a contract which the company is supposed to, is more or less called upon to adhere to, but very often when you look at that contract, the corporation has enormous control over what goes on in that contract. When you put all that together, it's a real problem. What we end up doing is putting a very important public resource into the hands of a for-profit private corporation that can pretty well determine what it wants to do in terms of carrying out the terms of the contract. And this is a real set of problems I think most people have begun to see.
Now, Tony Clark, you were in Mexico City for the World Water Forum and there with a lot of members of civil society and protest groups in Mexico and from around the world, basically countering the message of privatization. Tell us a bit about what happened in Mexico City.
Besides the World Water Forum, which was the official event that had people, as I indicated before, from around the world, there were non-government organizations that had organized a 3-day forum of events focusing on various aspects of the privatization of water services. And then you also had mass social movements that were meeting, indigenous peoples, peasant movements. And then you also had a huge march that occurred on the 16th of March through the streets of Mexico City that demonstrated with something like 45,000 people, largely from the urban social movements, who turned out in great numbers to protest against the privatization of water services. I believe this was the largest single march that we have seen so far in defense of water and against the privatization of water services.
Tony, what are opponents of privatization doing to really prevent further privatization around the world of communities' water resources?
Well, a big part of it is building that local community resistance to any attempts to privatize or for a for-profit corporation to come in and take over local water services. The latest information is that the big for-profit water privateers have decided pretty well that they've given up on Latin America and they're moving elsewhere. That certainly is one major thrust of what's going on. A second thing that's happening is that there is a big emphasis in our movement on trying to advocate and put forward alternatives to the what is known as the P3s, the private-public partnerships, which emphasize public-community partnerships or public-public partnerships. using the strengths of one to help strengthen the other, and this kind of building of alliances can be very important for the future of public water.
That was Tony Clark, director of Canada's Polaris Institute and co-author, along with Maud Barlow, of the book Blue Gold, The Fight to Stop Corporate Theft of the World's Water. Contact the Polaris Institute by calling area code 613-237-1717 or visit their website at www.polarisinstitute.org. Every year for the past 28 years, an international sacred run for peace and Mother Earth has been organized by Dennis Banks, co-founder of the American Indian Movement. This year, in addition to crossing the U.S. from San Francisco to Washington, D.C., participants took a detour of almost 1,000 miles to visit the Houma tribal nation on the bayous of southern Louisiana. They added hurricane recovery to the causes they are running and walking for. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus walked with the group along the bayou through Golden Meadow on March 27th, home to many of the 15,000 Houma people scattered through this fragile land that was battered by both Hurricanes Katrina and Rita. Marcus Atkinson is a peace activist from a small town near Melbourne, Australia, who has participated in Sacred Runs since 1993 and is co-founder of another group of peace walkers and runners called Footprints for Peace. With the sounds of Buddhist prayer drums and passing trucks in the background, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Atkinson about his group's peace walks and why he believes it's grassroots movements such as these that will lead to a more peaceful world.
2003, I organized a walk with my partner, and we walked from Roxby Downs in Australia, which is very close to where the English tested nuclear weapons in the 1950s. It had a devastating effect on the Aboriginal communities out there, and a lot of servicemen and a lot of the surrounding farming areas and stuff. So 2003 was the 50th anniversary of those tests, so we decided to walk from there to Hiroshima because of the connection with nuclear weapons. But also Roxby Downs is one of the largest uranium mines in the world, and a lot of that uranium goes to Japan to fuel their over 50 nuclear reactors in Japan. I came from India, actually, to join this particular walk and run. I was in Australia before that, around October, November, and I left for India in early December because we did a walk through India to retrace Gandhi's salt march, because last year was the 75th anniversary of Gandhi's salt march. So a group of Japanese Buddhist monks and together with some Gandhian ashram people decided to retrace that salt march from Ahmedabad to Dandi. So we did that and finished around the middle of January, and then came to San Francisco in early February to join the beginning of this one.
What can you say about this one so far, and especially about being down in the Houma tribal nation area?
Yeah, I think like all the walks and all the runs, they're always different, but the one thing that is really similar, no matter what country it is that the people who have been persecuted the most and have had the most taken from them and like live in poor conditions are the people who show the most love and share the most with us. And it seems to be everywhere. Like just a few months ago when we were walking in India as well, it was always the poorest communities that really welcomed us with open arms. And it's been the same here with the Houma Nation and everything they've faced through the Katrina and Rita last year, and having no support from the government and FEMA and the Red Cross and everyone. They've kind of been left by themselves to do what they can, but it's made them stronger, and they've opened their arms to us incredibly, and it's been an amazing 3 or 4 days that we've had down here.
Do you think it makes it? I mean, it makes a difference to you, I'm sure. But do you think it makes a difference to, for peace in the world?
I think it does. I think, like, I mean, just this isn't going to change the world. But, like, I think we're doing our thing, and it does have an effect on some people. Like, so many times, like here at the Homa Nation, and like so many other places that I've walked and ran through, that the people are always talking about how much strength it gives them to continue, and like us meeting with them gives us strength to continue. And I don't think peace is something we can just create tomorrow or something. Like, it's a very long term commitment that we have to make, and the only way for us to have the strength for that long-term commitment is to keep being with each other and meeting with each other. And I mean, to be honest, like, I have no faith at all in the political system and the big organizations and stuff. I think, like, a lot of the big organizations that were really good, like in the 70s, like Greenpeace and like all these other kind of big organizations, are kind of lost in the political process at the moment. And I think, like, the change that really gets made is from a grassroots level. And I think, like, we need to keep this spark of grassroots alive, and yeah, and then eventually, like, something will spark, and like that the whole big grassroots movement will happen again, like it did in the 70s.
That was Marcus Atkinson, co-founder of Footprints for Peace and a longtime participant in the Sacred Run. For more information, visit www.footprintsforpeace.net. To contact the Sacred Run, which is scheduled to arrive in Washington, D.C. on Earth Day, April 22nd, call area code 415-595-1238 or visit their website at sacredrun.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Chris Ferriero, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.